Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Just the Facts with me, Alex Zane, the podcast that takes a journey through the cinematic CV of a different guest every week to uncover some fascinating facts about their career. And thank you for being here for our fantabulous 14th episode. If you haven't done so already, I know I keep saying this, I'm probably going to keep saying it as well. Please do hit the subscribe button right now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to us and a brand new episode will be delivered to your device, to your ears, into your brain forevermore. Ad infinitum, as long as we keep making them. Also on that note, if you could leave us a little review or a rating, that would be brilliant as well. If you've got the time, if you're hearing this and going, I can do that right now, do it right now. I know you can do it on Apple Podcasts. If your platform, your pod platform allows it, then a little rating and review would be amazing for us and hugely appreciated. Don't forget as well, for all the latest updates about upcoming guests and to get in touch with us, we will get in touch back. Most likely, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter at JTFpod. And finally, if you wish to watch this interview, the full interview will be going up on our YouTube channel, Just the Facts with Alex Zane. If you subscribe to that and you like watching your interviews rather than having them in your ears, then you can do that. The full interview every Friday after the podcast is released. Right then, my guest this week is about to release his directorial feature film debut, Small Engine Repair, that he also wrote and stars in based on his successful stage production of the same name. A lot of information there. We get into that in the chat. We find out a little bit about his journey from stage to screen and how this idea for Small Engine Repair has gestated over the years to become this brand new movie. It's about three old friends getting together for a night of drinking and laughter, which suddenly takes a sharp left turn into dangerous territory. And that's all I'm going to say. That is all I'm going to say right now, because I don't think you need to know too much more about it. I certainly watched it without knowing too much, and it's a very exciting, thrilling, darkly funny movie. And I mean, look, if you want to watch the trailer, that will tell you more. But, you know, maybe just watch the film when it hits cinemas on September the 10th, followed by a digital home release in October. So we talked about that. We talked about him getting behind the camera for the first time. We talked about him making the leap from being on the LA theatre scene into screenwriting, working on the Jake Gyllenhaal film Stronger. We talked a lot about Italian food and our mutual love of it. I hope you enjoy the episode. It was a real pleasure having him on the show, so please welcome to Just the Facts, the excellent John Polono. Of course, because it's good morning for you. Good morning, Los Angeles?
Yes, sir. It's about 10 a.m. here.
Okay, that explains the coffee. I like a coffee with my interviews, but we're nearly at 6 o'clock here, and I just won't sleep. I won't sleep, John. Yeah.
It'll keep you up. See, I don't know, man. I don't know if it's being Italian and having an after dinner coffee my whole life. So it just doesn't keep me up. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's good. That's good. I mean, I will have an after dinner coffee. Yeah, you're right. That's a very specific scenario. Yeah. Cause obviously you got a belly full of food and
Different.
And an Italian meal as well. It doesn't have to be, but for me, it's a lot of carbs. There's a lot of pasta that's going down my throat.
Yeah.
I remember I found it very surprising. Have you been to Italy yourself?
I have, yes.
Do you go a lot? Have you got family there?
I do have family there. I was planning on bringing my kids there. And then the pandemic hit, we were sort of gearing up for it. But now when things settle down, I'd like to go back. We have a lot of relatives will come here and visit, and, you know, with social media, we stay in touch. But my daughter's 16, so she's getting to an age where she's trying to connect more with her roots, and always sending me like TikToks of like some villa in Italy, and we're talking about going back. Yeah, but I mean, I loved it. I you eat like a king.
Yeah, it's such good food. It's that weird thing though, isn't it? Because obviously out there, pasta is not the main dish. I think here in the UK, and I think maybe in the US as well, like it's the pasta is the main course. But out in Italy, it's like you have a pasta dish and then you have the meat or fish.
Well, it was funny, man. I went out there with my dad when I was like, I think 20 for the first time. And it had been a while since he went. He was going on business and he brought me and dropped me off. And then I spent about a week and a half with all these cousins. But when I first landed all jet lagged and stuff, they brought out a plate of food and I ate it. And I was like, this is amazing. And there's like 15 adults just watching me because I was the first sort of, you know, of my generation of the family to come over. And I didn't realize they only put one thing on each plate. So I like eat it and they gave me a bunch. But then a new family would come in with their signature dish and their wine. And I mean, I was shit faced and like I've never eaten so much in my life within the first like 2 hours. And they're all just kind of staring, watching. And it was like you said, because I was just like, oh, this is the thing.
Yeah. It's so good. I mean, we've got other stuff to talk about, but the food up there is just incredible. I remember I once went to, it was off the Amalfi Coast, an island of Capri, and they brought out this like really simple dish, just pasta with this tomato sauce. And I was like, just tell me what's in it, because I want to make this at home. And the guy, in the nicest way possible, just went, yeah, you cannot make this at home. And I'm like, just tell me what's in it. He's like, these are tomatoes from the soil on the mountain of Vesuvius. It's because of where they come from. It's not like, hey, just pop down to your local supermarket and get some tomatoes. It's where the ingredients are grown.
Yeah, no, it's great, man. My father's mother, his mother and father came over from Italy on the boat, but she was the best cook I ever knew. And her signature dish was gnocchi, which is a potato pasta, which we grew up with. And just took it for granted. And then when she died, we were like, oh shit, that was so good. And it's been very difficult to find its match, because a lot of these things are like peasant foods. I mean, they weren't wealthy villages and they made the best with what they had with like you said, simple homegrown ingredients. That's not meant to be like a $90 dish. It's like, there's a guy in downtown LA, there's a restaurant called Macaroni Republic, which to me is like pretty much the best Italian I've had since my grandmother died. My Nona died. And like no dish is over like $17. And it's really within that sort of philosophy of simple, like handmade, but not crazy, trendy, expensive. And it's really good. If you're in LA, you hit me up. I'll bring you out there.
That sounds incredible. Cause yeah, I mean, it's weird. Like the food in LA is so good. Cause in my head, like when I first went out there, I was like, American food. Okay. So, you know, you got your burgers, your fries, to go to LA, especially I think in the last maybe 10, 15 years, the quality of the food and the restaurants there has just exploded. It's like you can get anything and the ingredients. It's really amazing. You've lived there a while now, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been here about 20 years and I agree with the food on that. I mean, you know, coming from Boston and New York, it didn't have a North End. It didn't have a Little Italy. So it took a while to find a time, but there's, you know, Mexican food here is like amazing. And we live sort of in a Persian area in the valley. Unbelievable Persian and Armenian food, which you just like, I mean, I never had until I met people who were Persian. And when I lived in New York City, you kind of develop a taste for it. So LA is kind of spread out. So it's like a little harder to find, but you know, and then you go to Boston. It's funny, man. I was just with my family in Boston and everyone's hungry and they're like, let's get Mexican. And I'm like, I'm not eating Mexican food in Boston. Like I can go 10 feet from my house out here and it's like exquisite. You know, you got to know what you have. But LA, I mean, sushi, all that shit you can get here. Oh, by the way, can I swear? Is that bad? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's fine, man. It's
sorry, just hard not to. And when I'm around adults, because I got, you know, kids, I'm always having to watch my language. I kind of enjoy the freedom. Yeah. So you got to know what you get regionally and, you know, get the right stuff. But
So you still got family up that end of the US, Boston area as well? Because I'm right in thinking you grew up in New England. So that part of the country.
Correct. I grew up in southern New Hampshire and I got family, you know, a lot in Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, sort of spread out around that area. So we just we went back. My mom recently passed away and we had her memorial and we got to see a lot of cousins we hadn't seen, you know, certainly since the pandemic, but even from beyond that. So it was, you know, it was bittersweet, but it was great to see people from kind of all over Connecticut, all that stuff kind of getting together. And my mom grew up in at this lake house in Wrentham, Massachusetts, and we all hung out there one day and it was you know, it was really good to see everybody. All the accents are like so harsh, you know, like Rhode Island, New York, fucking New Hampshire. It's like insane, everybody. And I got this aunt from my auntie from Rhode Island, and she's got the thickest accent of anyone I've ever met. And I just like, I love it. Like you grow up and you don't really hear it. And then you leave and you come back and you're like, my God, just keep talking.
Yeah, I think I've been to the US a few times, but I think my education on that New England accent came from the scene between Brody and his wife in Jaws, where it's like, get the car, you know, down to the
back the car and have it. Yeah.
So small engine repair, that is that's taking you back to that part of your life, I guess, to a certain extent, because you actually started writing when you were still living up in New Hampshire, and you were very young when you first, I guess, caught the bug, fell in love with the idea of, if not writing, but being a writer and learning how to become a writer.
Yeah. I mean, I won this. It's funny, man. It's like I definitely had that itch, but you kind of, what you get rewarded for as a kid, or you kind of see a certain reaction you like. And, you know, I was very young. I was like in third grade and I won this like Young Authors Award. And I wrote this book. I mean, I didn't know any better, but like there was this book I read in the library about a raccoon and a kid who had it. And I was like, oh my God, like I plagiarized like half of it without knowing what it was. And I drew it and I changed it up, but I didn't get it. And I won this award. But that's definitely, I really enjoyed that element of it and having this imagination, drawing pictures. And so I always did that. I mean, I didn't really grow up in an area that I was exposed to artists per se, or like people who definitely did that for a career. So it was kind of, you know, hidden, I guess, a little bit, or I didn't, it took me a long time to have the balls to say, this is what I want to do and find it. And, you know, I had some really key teachers in my kind of smaller town who kind of nurtured it in a moment where, like, I don't know if they didn't, you know, give me that response or that support. I don't know if I would ended up doing it. And then reading, I was a voracious reader, especially back at the time. This is obviously pre-internet, so it's like you actually had to read books. And I remember getting obsessed with like Stephen King and like reading everything he did, and then, you know, all that stuff. And always, I initially thought I wanted to be like a horror fiction writer. And then I just was always obsessed with movies. I always wanted to be a director. And then, you know, it just kind of led to it. And then got into theater later when I moved to LA, and theater is really what sort of brought me to another level in terms of finding my voice and figuring out how to tell a story and characters and dialogue and all that stuff. So
it's so interesting. You read a lot of Stephen King, only because I was reading his sort of semi-autobiography, semi like a guide to new writers, Stephen King on writing.
It's
a good book, isn't it? It's a really, really interesting book. But he talks about this idea that people often say, yeah, I want to be a writer. And he's like, well, do you read? And they're like, I don't have time for reading. He's like, if you don't read books, you can't be a writer. Like the one thing you have to do to be able to learn like the craft of writing is to read books.
No, I mean, it's totally true. I think, you know, I find, you know, writing as a career, it's harder to just read for pleasure sometimes. And, you know, when you get into a book, it just gets you thinking a certain way. It gets to just sort of gets the juices flowing. And then, you know, I know when I don't do that for a bit, it kind of throws me off. And you know, watching movies as well, obviously, and things like that. But there's like passive watching where you can just kind of kick back and kind of watch it. And then you watch stuff where it's like digs into you and it kind of changes and you're like, oh shit, I didn't think about that. So yeah, I mean, it's like exercise, you know, for me, it's like, I have a, you know, weight set and stuff in the garage. And like, I try to work out consistently, but there's those nights where get the fucking kids to sleep. I'm finally at time. It's like 9:30. And I'm like, it's the last thing I want to do. And then in my head, I'm like, every time I work out, I'm always happy I do. Always. I feel better during, after, and the next morning. And I'm like, you idiot. But then I'm like, right before, sometimes you just, you wuss out. And I'm like, why do you think? So it's the same kind of thing. I'm like, if I pick up a book and get 10 pages in and just start itching for it, it's better than picking up the phone and messing around or checking, you know, social media, or doing all that stuff. It just, it gets the, you know, the muscles going, so to speak.
Yeah. It does. Although that is very impressive. If you sometimes do physically work out last thing at night, that's incredible. I can't imagine like ever wanting to do that. I mean, like I think I made the mistake. I once very briefly had a personal trainer and it was fine, but he used to talk all the time and I hadn't exercised ever. And he'd be asking me questions and I'd be just like struggling for breath, like having to answer these questions. And in the end, I just packed it in. So he was not a good trainer is what I'm saying.
That's like the equivalent of the dentist when they ask you questions, when they get all that shit in your mouth and you're like, what do you want me to do?
So before you got to LA, and became part of the LA theater scene, which I want to talk to you about because I find that quite interesting as someone who spent a bit of time in LA. But were you writing screenplays before then? Before sort of starting to write for stage, were you sort of like practicing the craft of screenwriting?
Yeah, I mean, I think I went the typical route. I loved movies, but I didn't really understand the construction of them. And then I, you know, right after I graduated college, I lived in Colorado for about a year and a half in like a trailer park and then this other little cabin with my girlfriend at the time. And I wrote some fiction, some nonfiction, and maybe one of the worst screenplays ever written.
Go on. What was it about?
You know, I think, you know, you look at Stephen King, for example, and he's a type of writer who openly admits like he doesn't outline. He's not a structuralist. He has an idea and he lets those characters go. And, you know, some writers do that. And you hear even like Tarantino, who obviously I love very much, talks about sometimes he gets the character so sharply realized that they start telling the story. And, you know, I kind of went that route initially and, you know, it just was terrible. And then I moved to New York City with a couple of guys I had met. I did a summer exchange at NYU. It's pretty much like all I could afford. I was in-state at UNH. You pay the UNH, you know, you go there for and your credits transfer, whatever. And I took this like compressed, I think it was like two semesters worth of filmmaking, the sight and sound class for the whole summer. And I mean, and it changed my life. It was the sort of biggest epiphany I ever had, going from, you know, creative writing classes and sort of being around, you know, college kids to being around like people who wanted to make films, who saw films, who had the reference level that I was creating and, you know, and diverse people from all over, all different economics and all over the world and just countries I had never known anyone from. I mean, it was incredible. Like my brain popped open. So I met some people there that I really clicked with. And then I ended up moving to New York and we, you know, wrote screenplays and made short films and did all that stuff together. And I kept writing these screenplays and thought, you know, here's the plan, move out to LA. And I got a job in the mailroom at Castle Rock Entertainment. And I continued to write screenplays, and I got to know a guy in development, and I give him a script, and he'd get coverage on it. And the coverage would be like, you know, there's some cool moments in this, but like, I know this is your friend, but like, why is a 26-year-old writing this derivative Raiders of the Lost Ark shit? Mm-hmm. You know, I was writing movies about movies. You know, they were very derivative, and oh, I loved, you know, Indiana Jones. Let me create my Indiana Jones or whatever, do all that. And it just wasn't clicking. And then there's this guy, a buddy of mine, one of my first friends in LA, this guy, Phil Santani, he's a really funny dude. He's like in the mailroom. Mailroom's like a whole subculture at this place. And he was taking an acting class. And I was like, I'd done some acting at NYU just in the short films. And I was like, this is kind of fun. So I started taking this acting class with Laura Gardner. And I mean, and that changed my life, because they you do scene studies, you study a scene, but you have, and they don't give you movies or TV, they give you plays. So you read, you know, you get this little booklet and you got to read the whole play to know the context of your scene. And I just started reading, like, I mean, I'd been to one play before that. I was kind of a Philistine with that. I mean, I just was never exposed to it, you know?
Yeah.
And I just started reading these plays, and it, like, I was like, holy shit, I've never experienced writing like this. And I just devoured all of them. And then, you know, that really started writing one act plays, monologues, plays, and stuff like that. So it was really being part of that community and then seeing how the scenes are deconstructed as an actor, and then that lending itself to the writing and all that. And really just, it was like an epiphany. It was no longer writing derivative material that was like about movies. It was like being in it and saying, oh, from an actor's point of view, from a staging it, from all that, this is what it is, breathing that. And how a line of dialogue, you're sort of arming the actor with the ability to propel the story and the theme and do all that stuff. And I mean, look, being an English major, it clicked with me, because like, you're in, you know what it is you, there's so much, you know, write an 11-page paper on Heart of Darkness, you know what I mean? About do the Marxist reading of Heart of Darkness or whatever. And you pull a lot of it out of your ass because, you know, you're finding the image systems and all this stuff. And it's cool, but a lot of that is to sort of have teaching you how to think and how to run with an idea, which most likely the writer was like, I want to tell a cool story, and they have their intent. And if they create, you know, good art has multiple interpretations. But to be in there and start writing stuff and being like, okay, I'm going to write a line or a scene, and this is my meaning of it, and let's see what the actor does. And then it's up. And then, you know, seeing that immediate feedback. Look, when you write a movie, it'd be the best script ever written, it may sit on a shelf for years. Hmm. Best case scenario, you're not going to sit in an audience with it for a year and a half. Or there could be a pandemic and you've never seen an audience. When you write theater, whether it's for your class or for an audience, you get that immediate feedback. And you start, for me, it was like starting learning how to write for an audience, not a theoretical audience, but an audience there in terms of engaging them. And then you put shit up and some of it dies, some of it works. It's probably a lot like, I know you have a background in stand-up comedy. I found that, interestingly enough, I found comics inspirational to me throughout my career, and in particular for Small Engine Repair, in terms of finding the hard truths in that edge where to not lose, like, how far can I go? Like, to me, great stand-up comedy makes the audience uncomfortable sometimes. It's not just like, hey, let's laugh together. It's like, hey, let's laugh. And sometimes I'm gonna turn it at you and you're like, oof. Sometimes the best comedy I've seen, you get a little sick.
Yeah.
Not just because they're going to look at you and say shit about you, but you're like, oh, wow, that's true. And it resonates. You know what I mean? So a lot of that sort of temporal art form really informed me in terms of my voice as a writer, and then tapping into your truths, because it's like, I can't, you know, instead of having to imagine what a character, let me find something that I feel strongly about, that beats for me. And then, you know, and then obviously, you can't put two actors on stage without having subtext and conflict. You know, can't have two actors. Who wants to watch a fucking movie or a play with people kind of getting, they like kind of get along, kind of agree. You know what I mean? Like, the only time two characters should agree is if there's like aliens outside the door with like machine guns, then it's like, there's a conflict, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Therefore you have to. And I think what was interesting for me in terms of my background and where I came from and being around so many people and trying to absorb that is to really look at any specific issue and not be didactic about your writing. Be like, go to messy, uncomfortable places. So that was part of that wonderful period of time. And theater's always been that for me. And then, like I said, reading, I mean, I remember the first time I read Death of a Salesman, I was like, holy shit. Like, you know, I think it was assigned to me in high school and I just pretended I read it. You know what I mean? But then when you read it, like, what the fuck? Maybe you need a little more life experience. I don't know. And then just great writers, just really changed my life.
And you, and so in terms of the extremes, I guess, that you can explore and that you can push the writing on stage. And then are you saying that you by seeing the immediate reaction an audience gets, you can find sort of where the line is? I guess perhaps that applies more to stand-up comedy. I remember, you know, Chris Rock was talking about it in a lot of detail about why he banned phones at gigs, because it's like stand-up is one of the few environments where you have to. You don't get the opportunity to rehearse behind closed doors. You are rehearsing in front of an audience, and you know, to try stuff out, to find that line, you do push and push and push. And sometimes that pushing can be uncomfortable. And does the same thing apply to writing for stage as well? Are you learning where the line is, potentially not in terms of extremity so much as stand up, because you're not playing for the laugh always, but in terms of how far you can take an idea?
Yeah. I mean, for sure. Now, initially what attracted me to theater was that it was a fearless place. And, you know, we started a theater company, you know, that's why I met my wife in that class. We started a theater company, having then starting to produce plays. And it was very much the audience would sit down, the lights would go down, and it would be like, challenge me. Like, I want to talk about this, disturb me, provoke me. Let's think. Because the fact that you wrote a play, that you're performing a play, and we're all sitting here together, means that we are inquisitive to the nature of the world and we're open to ideas. So it's not propaganda, but let's get challenged. Like, if I never had any interest in the audience that I sort of came up around in seeing a play that just regurgitated a safe belief system they already had. You know what I mean? It's always like, push it. Now, sometimes it can be comedy, but it should be like refreshing and zig and zag and not just always edgy or whatever. I mean, I've written a lot of different plays, but it was always like the IQ goes up. And I, you know, I have a lot of sisters. I always try to write for the smartest woman in the room because I know them and that's who I love and that's who shaped me. So having that challenge, I was always like, how complex of a theme and an idea can you put out there? You know, I'd ever, you know, writing a play or a movie that you're like, war is bad. Like, okay. You know, finding some other nuance truth that will be truthful and honest and complicated enough that you can get your own meaning out of that. And that was sort of what was so exciting about it. And again, it's to go to stand-up comedy. If you're sitting in there and you're watching, you know, Dave Chappelle, you probably are ready to be like, all right, we're going to explore some shit. I mean, I may not agree with all of it, but I'm along for the ride. And that's part of the fun. You know, like, you don't go to like some spicy ethnic food if you're like, I don't like spice. It's like, stay home.
Yeah.
You know, that's why you're here. And that was the idea of it. So you want to, and the people will be disappointed if they weren't like, you know, leaning forward or have some sort of visceral reaction and, you know, experimenting with that form with a lot of plays and, in stuff I had written in terms of, to me, it was always like, how emotionally true can you get? I mean, you're breathing the same air as the actors and you're living in that. I think in live theater, very often, if it's funny, it's even more funny. If it's scary, it's scary. It's even more emotional because it is so communal. So you have to, I mean, you can't hold back.
Well, let's talk about specifics. Cause it began life as a play.
Yeah.
Small Engine Repair in, I think it was 2011. It debuted in Los Angeles. And what I was going to say, and this is more to do with my ignorance. I've often thought of Los Angeles as, you know, the hub of TV and film. That's sort of what it's known for, Hollywood. But there is actually, there is quite a thriving theater scene in LA that people don't often reference perhaps as much as when, you know, as a tourist, especially you're like, oh, New York, Broadway, off Broadway, you get that. But you don't think about LA in those respects.
I mean, certainly, and that's something LA has struggled with, but LA has a thriving theater community. I mean, there's a different support mechanism in New York, having done a lot of plays there, that, you know, you jump in a cab, you go to a play, you go to a movie. If there's just an ease, a fluidity of the city, LA is more spread out, but LA has the biggest community of actors anywhere on earth, you know, incredible actors. And most actors will all tell you that, you know, you go on a set of most TV shows or movies even, and it's like, hey, pick up that 30-pound weight. And you're like, okay. You go to theater and it's like, dude, pick up that 500-pound weight every night. It's like, you're really pushing it. So yeah, I mean, there's a great theater scene. It has its challenges for sure, but, and I know it's weird because like I lived in New York and I never even went to a play, and then I moved to LA and I get involved in the scene, but it, you know, it has its challenges, but it's thriving. I mean, I've seen some great plays here, and you know, that's sort of changed over the past, you know, 10, 15 years, is that LA is no longer considered like, you know, what is going on there? You know, it has some danger of being like a showcase sometimes, where you have a bunch of actors who are like actor driven theater companies who are like, hey, let's put this play together so we can get agents to come and casting directors. And, you know, there's always that element of it, but you know, the people I know who have the greatest longevity in LA theater, it's like they do it because they love the play. It's like, build it and they will come. I mean, and by the way, I've done those plays too, where I was like, oh my God, this will be good. It never really works out that way. Typically, you just got to do it because you love it. And people will go, you know, my first time I did a play in New York, I was like, holy shit, these audiences are huge. They're like pulsating to go see a play. They're like, great. Those audiences exist in LA. It's just more spread out and it's more like provincial. Like they're going to go to their neighborhood. Like it's hard to, if you do a play downtown, it's hard to get West Siders out there and stuff like that. But you know, it keeps going along, and I'm always surprised. You know, the reputation has been building. I've seen some unbelievable plays start from out here, and the talent is incredible. It's just, like I said, working on that whole thing. I wish there was a better public transportation system so people could.
I was going to say, I mean, look, you touched on it, man. I love parts of LA. I like Silver Lake a little bit because it feels like a little center, but I guess there are those kind of centers dotted around LA, like where you can sort of walk out of a building and there's like more than one restaurant within like an Uber ride away. But I think it's the 101 that goes from Santa Monica into West Hollywood. I sat in that for 3 hours in an Uber last time I was there. I was like, how has this city got such wide roads? And like, it just like, it's crazy the amount of time you spend in cars.
I'm not going to lie. I mean, the traffic is one of the things I hate the most about LA. There's no question. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just time it. Yeah. You time it, you make it work. It's more of a car culture. You know, I love my truck. I'll drive it. Like it's, to me, it's like, I get a great radio, comfortable seats. It's like driving a couch. And, you know, man, I get some peace. I listen to my music or a podcast or whatever. So, I mean, I don't mind. You just have to build in the time, but you know, it's not as easy. I mean, you can't get fucked up and jump in a cab and go and then be like, let's go out to eat and not worry about it and stuff like that. There's, you know, it's definitely more complicated.
Yeah.
But, you know, you get used to it. You find your neighborhood, you find your Trader Joe's, you find your bullshit, and then you just kind of orbit around that.
It's true. And I shouldn't moan because like actually Uber saved my experience of LA, because before Uber came along, I think there were like maybe three cabs in LA. Yeah, and like just like you're like standing on the street going, I actually don't know how to get back to my hotel. This is nuts. Yeah. But let's talk about Small Engine Repair, because that was that kind of hit big. It had great reviews and it was a very popular play. And it's something that I believe a lot of your work is influenced by your upbringing in New Hampshire, this being one of them. And how did you feel when it landed so well with people? Was there something about it that you felt, I guess the bottom line is, were you surprised, right? Or was it like, I know this is good. And I know this has got something in it that I'd be more surprised if people didn't come out and get this and understand this.
I've kind of given up on anticipating what people like. I know how to connect to an audience. I know they will like it, but in terms of the, I mean, you never know. So this was a little different, having done some sort of main stage, sort of primetime plays. This is part of a late night series that my wife was at the time was the producer. I think she still is, although everything's kind of frozen at the moment, but she produced these late night shows. And what the late night shows were, were typically more adventurous. And, you know, small engine repair was, I was like, let me just write it using references I know. You know, I kind of outlined the story. I just kind of wrote it and those characters were sharp in my mind. And that was sort of like the one or two times in my career that that sort of Tarantino approach worked, where I had a story loosely etched out and then I created these characters and they just sort of started to lead it. But what I took off was I took off the filter and I said, let me kind of use all of the sort of theatrical tools that I had learned in previous plays. One, you know, and then the necessity of it. But so anyway, it was late night, starts at 10:30. There was a play, Cormac McCarthy had this play, Sunset Limited, this two-hander that takes place before. It's like a dilapidated urban apartment. So you've got to use their light scheme. You got to use their soundboard and their set. You can fuck with the set, but you can't like change it. So it was his apartment. So I was in there and I had this idea and I was watching the play, which I love the play. And I was just like, oh shit, maybe that idea I had would work. Low stakes. And then I wrote this play, got this guy, David Maurer, who was like the technical director, was like really good with sets and being pragmatic. And he figured out a way to like, okay, let's put pegboards here. Let's roll in a couple lawnmowers. Director I'd worked with at the time, this guy, Andrew Block, was like, okay, it's cool. Let's read. And then we got, you know, and because of the necessities of lights up and lights down, you had to have no real scene changes. I mean, you could do them, but then it's like so complicated. Like, you know what I mean? You just, so I was like, let me create a master scene for a play. Lights up, you know, 70 minutes, lights down, that's it. A little bit of sound cues, but nothing too complicated because we got one person running the light board. We got a stage manager. You know what I mean? You got to keep the budget low in order to do it. So therefore, when it is that thing, I mean, look, it's similar to the movie. You keep the budget tight enough that you don't have to make those artistic compromises. And then you roll the dice and see how it goes. And the biggest thing I learned from that, and look, we didn't have time for previews. We didn't have any of that, you know, John Bernthal, who was in like one of the first readings, who was like, everything started to click. And he's like, I want to do this. And he was in between Walking Dead seasons. I think I'm allowed to tell you, but like, so he got into a little trouble with the law that like, he wasn't allowed to leave the city. And he, so he's like, what the fuck am I going to do? So we did this play and a couple other buddies, Michael Redfield, this other guy, Josh Hellman, who was in the Pacific with John. We all kind of went together. We read it. We were all like, oh shit, how are people going to react? I don't know. Now, some of these late night plays, we did Bingo with the Indians by Adam Rapp. Look that one up. I mean, they're super off the wall and fucked up and like, holy shit, crazy stuff. You know, Bingo with the Indians has a scene where these two, this guy deflowers a man. He has sex with him. And then the guy, he takes some of the blood from his ass and he wipes it on his chest across him. And it's like super erotic, crazy, inappropriate. I mean, you're like, holy shit, I can't believe it. It is so over the top. And, but it's 10:30 at night. Audience is like, cool, let's do this. And then there were other, you know, just crazy shit. So I was like, all right, I don't have to hold back. I can do this thing. But like I said, no previews. We're changing in the hallway. We're going on. And then we open and we're like, I don't know. We don't know how people will react. We know we're like our friends will dig it, but let's put it out there because the material was provocative, but also, so to me, it was always like,
hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I know what this is about, and I know what it's trying to say, but it's not going to spoon feed it. You know what I mean? It'll work beat by beat, but I know what I want to say about this, about being a father, about being from an environment where you straddle two worlds, about women. And I, you know, again, in the play was different than the movie in the sense that there are no women in the play. They were just spoken about. But I was like, how can I tell a feminist story unfiltered the way guys are, maybe when women aren't in the room, at least where I am from, and have it be about that, but not wrapped in a little bow, have it about that. And like, be like, let's fucking talk about this and create something like my favorite art, which is like, oh shit, I never, you know, there. So all the breadcrumbs are laid out in the play and in the movie, meaning like you could write a 12-page term paper on the feminist aspects of it. And I lay it out into me what is like borderline gratuitous detail, but you know, you never know. So I put all those pieces in there. We did it. And then, yeah, people just responded and they got it. And I mean, I think the great thing about the theater community, especially in LA, is that, you know, we had actors, we had transgender actors who were part of our community sitting next to like firemen and cops and some of Bernthal's like friends, the fighters who'd never been to a play before. And it had this community and people were drinking and having a good time. And look, by the way, you walk on and you sit down, like you ain't leaving. Once the lights come up, you can't leave. You're stuck. So we had them, but people really got it. And I think that was the most rewarding thing is people understood the intent and everyone had their own takeaway, but it was like, no question. It was this visceral communal experience. So we started having to put in extra seats and filling up that like 65 seat house. And then we moved to the main stage and then we're, you know, it's a 99 seat theater and we're setting up all these other seats. It became like a thing that, and I think because, you know, what happens is, look, you can make a Big Mac and everybody likes it. You know what I mean? But if you make something, and this is true, I think for a lot of art forms, you know, you do punk rock and you're gonna be like, I saw this awesome punk rock. Oh, Andy, you don't like that kind of music. You won't go. But Jesse, oh, you'll fucking love this. You know what I mean? So you start planting a flag and making a bold statement. You eventually start creating the audience that gravitate towards it. And we just started to snowball and do that. And the theater community was unbelievably supportive. And, you know, especially at that time, it was like adventurous. It was like punk rock doing it. And then we ended up moving to some other stages and then to New York and, you know, yada, yada, yada. But those first few performances, we were definitely like, oh shit, what do we have? Because you're very naked when you're in a play, in a new play, you just kind of don't know what you have, especially something like this, which, I mean, we really went out on a limb. And I think the material is very much, it's not pandering an audience at all. It's like, you know, so what's funny about what we do with the play and not the movie as much, but in the play, there's some very, and you, again, maybe this is very similar to stand-up comedy, is that you set the tone early. It's the kind of humor you're going to be in for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. And you kind of like, oh shit, that's where we are. Then you start lowering the defenses. So like 30 minutes into this play, you're like, I'm one of the guys. I get it. This is the rules. This is the language. It's like, here's the reality of this play. And you kind of, you get what it is. So once you have that, then the challenge becomes as an audience is like, okay, how can I subvert it even further? How can I continue to go? So it was really kind of that whole communal thing. I know I'm kind of going on and on and on. It was terrifying, but it was very exciting to sort of get that. And then, you know, moving to New York was a similar experience in terms of having audiences discover it and see it and you know, that mix of audiences. And, you know, that to me, that's what a certain type of art should be, that way, you know.
And was there a difference in the reception it got in New York because of the difference in the theater community there?
I mean, New York audiences, you know, and the play continued to evolve and in rehearsals. And then Joe Bonney came on as a director in New York, who's is like one of my mentors and my favorite frequent collaborators. And, you know, the play shaped through LA with all the actors, and then it continued to shape New York audiences. Most of the revisions had to do with timeline, actually, like the logic of it. They listen in a different way. I mean, granted, it was drunk, rowdy, late night LA audiences, but the New York audiences required a deeper logic to some of the things. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, what day of the week is it? What is it? And then, you know, the artistic director would be like, you know, here's a, like in the previews or whatever, the audiences were confused about what day did this happen and this happened, the timeline. Well, if she's, you know, if this happens to her here, how would it is? So I had to really chisel that out a little more, which was interesting. Mm. You know, the advantage of the LA plays on the variety of stages is they were much more intimate. So when things go haywire, you're in closer proximity to it. And in New York, you know, some of the staging is broader. So I was concerned, well, how much of this is like the magic trick of you're just like, holy shit, I can't go anywhere. Mm. But fortunately, it really translated very, very well. A little more Brechtian, a little more, you know, separate from the proceedings. So maybe it lost a little of that, but it gained it in terms of what I felt Joe really harnessed the theme in a really beautiful way. And in a way that actually both those directors especially informed not only my performance, but the theme of the material. Mm-hmm. And that she kind of did. And, you know, Joe has a couple of, you know, what she does in her plays, which is so brilliant. She creates a couple of sort of frozen static images that tell her story very subconsciously, you know, the play is a movement. And then you'll have a couple of moments that really say what it is. And I that was a great takeaway. Yeah, but the New York audiences were, I think by like the fifth performance, we started to have that phenomenon where you get the audience that's going to like it, you know?
Yeah. Let's take a little detour because obviously, you know, we're going to be talking about the film that was based on this play. Like you say, it has changed somewhat from the play. But before then, it was your screenwriting that took off. Is taking off the right word? Because off the back of the play, you, I'm guessing, started to have meetings with exec studios and follow a screenwriting path from the writing on Small Engine Repair.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, a Small Engine Repair got me my best acting gigs, pretty much, which was great, but not enough to sort of support a family and, you know, do that. And you know, I've always been primarily a writer, and the Small Engine Repair sort of became a hit around the time when the industry started to be more open-minded to seeing other writing samples and actually wanting other writing samples beyond just a screenplay. So the play became the calling card for the beginning part of my career until I had racked up a couple of, you know, scripts and stuff. So they would read that and be like, oh, this guy can do, you know, this or that. And like now play, I was sort of it felt like it was the beginning of the industry really appreciating playwrights in terms of other mediums. Mm-hmm. Now it's like the TV industry is filthy with playwrights. rightfully so. Because it's a certain skill set that you got to do. I mean, not all everyone makes the transition, but there's a certain skill set that is nurtured in that. So that the play was, getting me a lot of meetings and a lot of stuff, and then started to get some material. And then it was really sort of stronger, which was just worked out because, you know, it just clicked. And then one of the producers on that, Scott Silver, sort of has been doing this for a long time. And he was like, kind of helped mentor me through that process of writing a studio movie. And he and I have written a bunch of shit together since then. It was a beginning of a really great sort of creative partnership. But, you know, that sort of was the big thing that took it to a whole other level.
So Small Engine Repair, how did it initially come about? The idea, the opportunity, I guess, is the word, to take it to the screen. And also, I guess, was it always a definite thing that you wanted to direct it? Because obviously you've written it, you star in it, and you're directing it. And this is your feature debut as a director. Was there a point where you were like, that seems like an awful lot to be taking on? Or did you feel so familiar with your material that you were like, I'd be a freaking nightmare if I had someone else directing me in this?
I mean, I think if it came down to it, I would have directed it as opposed to be in it. But just to back up. So John Bernthal, who has become not only a dear friend, but like a real creative collaborator in a bunch of stuff. So we sort of met in that. And we were always like, we should make this into a movie. We should do it. It was always like something we always chatted about. I mean, he was instrumental in moving it to New York. And, you know, he and I have a whole, you know, Jesus, like a dozen projects going on at this point. But this was always one that we were like, I mean, there was a time I was like, let's fucking co-direct it. I mean, we're so fluid, he and I, in terms of our collaboration, that like that could have worked. But it became, you know, more and more of a reality, not only as his career took off and as I got more, and then things just started to click. It had stops and starts over the years. And then it kind of happened at, well, not really the right time in terms of a fucking pandemic, but in terms of thematically and how it places itself in a contemporary moment, it worked out. But, you know, look, it's easier to do an indie movie that's predominantly one location. There's all that stuff. You know, it's an acting piece. So it was all that stuff that I was like, I knew played to my strengths. And I mean, quite frankly, to roll the dice and take a risk, I was like, I don't know when I'll have this opportunity again. Let me just kind of go all in on it. And having played the character so much and being, you know, sitting at it, I just kind of knew it. And to be honest, I felt, as my first time directing, I'm like, to be in it, to be like sort of the thermometer in the bathwater while directing, I was like, it all just kind of clicked. The whole apparatus of the filmmaking was designed around this very unique situation and opportunity in terms of what it was. So I was terrified by it, but I was always like, well, fuck it. If I'm going to roll the dice, I might as well, you know, go all in. You know what I mean? Like, when are you ever going to get this opportunity again?
I mean, yeah, it sounds like the right thing to do. I will say at this stage, I was going to sort of explain a little about the story of the film myself, but I think actually because there's some big stuff that happens in it, and I don't want to blunder into spoiler territory here and end up, you know, ruining a huge turning point in the movie. So I thought I'd let you give us an idea of what Small Engine Repair is about. And then I have some questions about how it might have changed from what it was in 2011.
Absolutely. So, you know, it's the movie is, you know, it's about these three childhood friends who are sort of bonded over their love for my character's teenage daughter, who they were kind of helped raise in this sort of rougher working class neighborhood. And, you know, it's about sort of as she reaches a point where she's becoming a woman, things get more complicated. And then they're all kind of put to this sort of test of their friendship and their love. And it enters some really tense territory. And because these are not like, you know, accountants, these are guys who are quick to get into a fight and they're rough. So they're already living on the sort of that level, you know, that physical sort of visceral level. And, but to me, it's like a family drama with like super dark comedy in it with like a very sort of biting social commentary to it. That's sort of how I looked at it. And, you know, a character piece, an actor's piece, but to me, it's about this sort of highly unconventional family and just dealing with some, you know, issues that I'm always trying to work out. And I wanted to reflect them in all their messiness.
And I mean, like, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the film addresses, you know, the subject of toxic masculinity to a certain extent. And I mean, I think people's awareness and society's awareness in the last 10 years about this and about the issues around this and about it being a problem, I think that's changed. I think people are more aware now than possibly they were in 2011. And so right. In that respect, did you have to look back at what you'd written and go, okay, well, some of this is going to have to change because it's now more commonplace, or at least more at the forefront of people's minds than it was when I first wrote it?
I mean, I definitely agree with that. But to me, it was always like I don't think this particular class of guys has been examined very often with such sort of raw honesty. And I think a lot more of the country is like this than is reflected in pop culture. Certainly in theater, I hadn't seen a lot of, you know, working class New Englander type that aesthetic. You know, I think toxic masculinity has become a lot more of a common used word. I mean, it's not like it was running through my head. I just said, I want to be honest about this, about the conflict and about the pitfalls and the ugliness, as well as the beauty of this camaraderie. And, you know, art, drama and art is conflict. So inevitably that's going to go there. You know, I felt with the Me Too movement coming out, it was a great opportunity to really look at the material through that lens and see what's going on, that sort of reckoning, which the play has always sort of dealt with that. I have grown up around a lot of women, as I said, and you know, I was no stranger to hearing and experiencing, you know, that point of view my whole life, and kind of felt like having a foot in both worlds, both having a very open communication with really strong women who had difficult situations in their life, but then also being like growing up in an environment where it was very, you know, difficult to express emotions and do that and be more of a tough guy. So I kind of like felt in between those two worlds, and that was those collision is ultimately what the play was about. But then when Me Too came out, I was like, oh wow, here's an opportunity. Not Me Too came out, but you know what I mean? Hmm. When we started to have more awareness of that, is like how to add to that conversation in a different way and how to harness what's working in the play and contemporize it. And the biggest transition from the play to the movie was the inclusion of these female characters who are very strong and as flawed and as sort of vibrant as anybody else. And having that breathe that life and have that statement, which, you know, again, when I say I made what I felt is like a hyper masculine, unfiltered material for women, because this is my movie that says I've been listening to you, you know, my whole life. And here's a point of view of it. That's not a fairy tale. It's like showing the complexity of these situations of, you know, of all of these myths that we hear of, you know, the father with a shotgun thing, the Taken, the Liam Neeson revenge, you know, subverting that, as well as, you know, how much of misogyny is in humiliation and all of this stuff, and really kind of packing it in there and putting these images and these ideas there that, like, I know the women in my life who would be like, okay, at least I hope, is that I'm understanding that through this very unconventional cast of characters and talk about it. I mean, the whole thing is really revolving around all of these men, and it's all dictated by their relationship with women and instead of toxic masculinity, I would almost say like sort of the masculine and the feminine inside of each one of us, and whichever one is sort of dominating in any given moment, and that like constant struggle of where it is. But like, I thought with the Me Too movement, it was like, finally, oh wow, we have to listen to women, you know, wow, this is what it is. And it's like, well, shit, they've been saying this all along, if you've been listening, so to speak. Anyway, that was sort of, as I mean, even talking about it, it's so emotional and complicated that I just felt the only way to really address that was to create an emotional and complicated and provocative situations. Basically,
it's a great film, by the way. I don't know if I've said that yet. I really loved it, and I found it.
Maybe I did. Sorry, Salim.
But I found it very exciting to watch for one of the reasons you just touched on that. And actually, I thought about it a little bit when you were saying, you know, with the opening of the play, you'd sort of really let people know what they were in for with this play. You'd sort of go, this is what you're in for. This is the kind of humor. This is your introduction to our world. And I don't think I could probably, if I thought about it a little harder, think of movies that had a similar representation of guys on screen. But I don't think I've seen that working class New England before. And it was a really exciting journey to sort of go to get to know these guys. And I think at the start, it was a little bit of a shock. I was like, I don't have a cinematic reference point for these people, which isn't a bad thing in this day and age, you know, with cookie cut movies still being made every day. You're like, fuck, I'm sitting up now. I want to know who these guys are. I want to understand this relationship. And it's abrasive. And it's sort of scary, but it's also really funny at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had a a girlfriend from the UK early on, and she was great, but so smart, so educated, and such a filthy mouth. And I was like, it reminded me of New England where people swear so much, or there's just those characters. Like, you'll have a grandma who'll be like, "Oh, put the fucking toilet seat down." Like, you know, like these really strong characters. So, you know, I definitely amplified it in terms of that, but more it was like the device of these guys who are the last people who would maybe have this sort of epiphany, or how can we experience it through their eyes? I mean, there's no movie if these guys are educated and well-balanced and all that stuff. And, you know, whatever happens, happens. They're like, okay, well, here's the healthy way to deal with it. It was seeing that stumble through. And you know, I think, I mean, I know a lot of guys like this, and, you know, it's, what's been interesting is in doing the play, you would have a lot of people come up to me from Australia or whatever and be like, "Oh my God, my dad has a shop like that in Australia. That's my uncle. That's my mother. She's tough as nails. She has it." You know what I'm saying? Like, these communities of people get it. And one thing that was always interesting to me, so to back up, in terms of what I was always surprised with from the reaction of the play and to some extent the movie, although we haven't had that much due to, you know, the fucking apocalypse, but the women really connected with it emotionally, the father-daughter story. And what I think we are is, I think we're at a moment where women, you know, maybe in their 30s and their 40s, their fathers who they love are old school, and they know they love them, but they just don't know how to talk way and do it. So they get that. Like, I know my dad loves me. Like, our costume designer, Mia, always said that. She's like, I know my dad would do the same thing. And that's real. Is it right? Is it wrong? It's just, it's a real reaction. Like, there are those holdovers, and there is that fumbling towards the next step of defining what a modern man is. So, and another thing that was really interesting is, so when we did the play in New York City, Keegan Allen played the Chad character, the younger dude. And Keegan was like on Pretty Little Lies, a great dude, but he has a fan base that's like these like prepubescent, you know, 11 to 14 year old girls from all over the country and all over the world. So you do the show and you come out, it's like me and Badge and PJ, and Badge and PJ are like, you know, they're movie stars in their own right. Like, people love them, but not these like 12 year old girls, like, fucking love Keegan. So I'm talking like, you know, it's like a 350 seat theater, maybe 40 of them at any given night were Keegan fans. So you'd go out and there'd be this big crowd and they'd be screaming as the stage doors open, and they'd see me and they'd be like, "Oh," and I'd walk to the side and hang out, and like, and then Keegan would come out and he'd sign autographs. But then the moms would come up to me in Badge and PJ, and they were like, "Listen, my daughter dragged me to this to see Keegan." And she's like, 5 minutes in, I thought this is the worst mistake I ever made because of the language. And then she's like, about halfway through, I started to get it. And then she's like, at the end, I mean, it's not like, the material doesn't exist to teach a lesson per se. It's a little more complicated than that. But they were like, "Look, give me and my daughter a lot to talk about." And I'm really happy about that. And she's like, "And not only that, I dated Sueno in high school. I did that." You know what I mean? Like, they're like, "I get that guy." Maybe you didn't end up with him, but they get that. The construction of the characters being specific sort of archetypes. So they appreciated that honesty. But again, that takeaway of from what it was, which is like, wow, I'm going to have a real talk with my daughter. And you know what I'm saying? Which I've had a little of that with the movie, again, in the limited screenings we've done, that I've been shocked to see, like, some friends who brought their kids that were 15 and they fucking loved it.
And you've watched it with an audience. I was going to say, because obviously, like you say, you know, we've been in a very strange time and we're still not fully out of it. But have you had the opportunity to sit down with an audience and watch the film?
Not in a great way. I mean, we had like, two screenings for friends of rough cuts. And I've never had the full final film projected in an audience. We did a drive-in, which was like super low res, you know, the fucking guy running it had like a, you know, like a VCR thing blinking for an hour. And, you know, I was like going out of my mind. I was like, this sucks. I mean, it's like, watch it on your phone. But that's the closest we sort of had to a screening, and then got to kind of talk communally. I mean, most of it's been, you know, sharing links and that and stuff, which is heartbreaking to me, because this material, which comes from a play that is not taken out of context, it's watched communally. And again, if you're sitting in an audience and you have, you know, all different stripes of people and everyone starts laughing together, it's similar to comedy, I think. It's like you're giving permission you know, it's like, I love it when you watch like a comedy special and it's like a Dave Chappelle or some like edgy, he's like a edgy black comedian and they'll say some joke, like making fun of white people and they'll cut to the white guy in the audience. And he's like, okay, I go, you know, like, I love that. So I love that element of like, come on, man, let's call each other out on their shit, so to speak. So anyway, no, I haven't had that experience in full.
It's worth seeing. I watched it on a link. I'm lucky enough to have quite a big TV, so you know it looked good because it's a cinematic movie. You have a lot of plays, and this isn't a comment on the quality of these films that were adapted from plays. You've got, you know, great film like Fences, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. What was the one with Christoph Waltz in it? Carnage, I think, that have come from plays and very much feel like filmed plays. But this feels to me like you sort of went, I want to do something where it is slightly more, you know, using the tools of cinema.
I mean, that's a really good way to put it because, you know, I mulled it over and John and I had, you know, countless meals together where it was always like, how do we harness what works in the move in the play cinematically? Now, a play is a master scene and your eye goes where it goes. And, you know, part of the fun in that is like, holy shit, what are they going to do on stage? Where do I look? Do I look over here? I'll miss that. So you're kind of in the moment, whereas a movie, obviously, you're literally directing where it goes. But it was like, what works and what's easier to do on stage is sort of to build the momentum of the train ride of what's going on. And like, although there's safety in being like, I know they can only do stuff. Sometimes you see a play and there's squibs, there's explosion. You never know. If you care about a character enough, you don't want them to get a paper cut in that, but there's still that safety. Now in a movie, you can do whatever you want. Now, it was more about, like you said, finding a team that really harnessed it and made it lean into the visceral quality of it. I mean, one of the greatest compliments I got about the play, consistent compliments, was always people were like, I forgot I was watching a play. I got pulled in. And so it was trying to do that in a movie, a little bit like, you're not sure where this is going to go. It's not playing by the rules the way the play didn't play by the rules to do that. But how do you do that cinematically? And it was, you know, I think the movie is more grounded than the play. The humor is thrown away. You know, in the play, there's like, you do it night after night, you plan it. There's moments of humor, there's zingers. It's more, it has a particular musical pattern to it. The movie's more, you know, rough about that stuff. So harnessing the movie, I mean, that was a very sort of like analytical conversation that I had a lot of is to how to make it cinematic and how to do that. And that lent itself, like, look, I knew that the bread and butter of the play as well as the movie was going to be the characters and the acting and the story and everything else sort of had to harness that and flow with that. So I found this great, you know, DP Matt Mitchell, who had done documentaries, who created a situation where we could do some new setups very quickly. So it was always in the moment. It was all that. It's like everything went to kind of support that. But in terms of the opening it up and doing that, it was like, you know, a good friend of mine, a periodic writing partner, like one of my best friends, this guy, Kemp Powers, his play One Night in Miami was done a year after Small Engine Repair. And he adapted it into a movie. It was a huge hit. He was nominated for an Oscar last year. And he and I always had these conversations and, you know, his adaptation in some ways was he went a different way, but his movie is very smart and it's about a movement and it's about social injustices and it's very nebulous, huge themes. In a way, what I did was the other way where I leaned into the visceral life and death struggle, which is more cinematic than theatrical. Mm-hmm. Inevitably the life and death thing, you know what I mean? The tension of that, the tightening of the noose is more cinematic. Some of those other adaptations you describe struggle a little bit in film, in my opinion, because the crux of the plays, and I love the plays, are thematic. The stakes are not as simple and is not as high. So with Small Engine Repair, the movie, it was just ratcheting up the stakes.
I mean, it's a great film. I mean, we mentioned John Bernthal. Shea Whigham is fantastic in it. I hope I'm pronouncing this. Ciara Bravo, who plays your daughter, Crystal, in it. Man, can she drop an F-bomb well? She is fantastic. Oh, man,
she's the best. She's amazing. I mean, the film wouldn't have worked if you didn't have a Crystal who you loved and were like, when she's not on screen, you're like, where did she go? That's like literally wouldn't have worked without her. She was incredible.
And you mentioned earlier from your experience of writing Stronger, which, again, I'd recommend if anyone hasn't seen Stronger. It's a fantastic film. Jake Gyllenhaal, you worked with David Gordon Green on that, who I think you probably have kind of similar sentiments to in terms of as a man, he can deliver comedy, but also dark comedy, along with some really substantial drama as well. So
I can see that. I shadowed him during the making of Stronger. I mean, he was the biggest singular sort of film directing influence on me. And I love the guy. I mean, we have a bunch of stuff in the works. He's amazing, but I really watched him on set and I was like, oh, you can do that. You can do between him and then Giovanni as a theater director. I mean, those two, I think that my roots of a director sprung from seeing them work and how David creates a set, like the actors, everybody on the set, you don't feel like you're making a movie. You feel like you're there and it's like, hey, it's about you. Like, let's do it. You know what I mean? It's not that, it's not precious. It's just real.
And one of the films that is constantly being mentioned, and I don't know where you are with it at the moment, because it feels like it's been gestating for about 2-3 years, maybe, which is the Hulk Hogan biopic, right, which you're writing with Scott Silver, Todd Phillips, yeah, and Chris Hemsworth is set to play Hulk. What's going on? Where are we with that?
I mean, look, man, I'm so terrified to say anything about that. I don't know what I can say. I would just say it's going. The material's great. Everybody's great. You know, Scott, like I said, we've written a bunch together and he is just fucking awesome to work with. And Todd Phillips, who I've gotten to know, they're great. Listen, it's going to be an amazing movie. I don't know when. I mean, look, I that's not a movie I think you can make with COVID protocols because, you know, there's wrestling scenes with like, you know, 20,000 people. So I mean, I don't know how that's going to go, but, I honestly, if I was a betting man, I would say it's going to get made and it's going to be a fucking great movie.
Yeah. You would keep getting drip fed by Hulk Hogan himself going, Chris Hemsworth's in crazy shape for this movie, which seems like, you know, you just sort of go, when is Chris Hemsworth not in crazy shape? That's that's a weird thing.
But there's there's Marvel muscles and then there's WWF muscles. So I think it's a whole other thing.
Yeah, but I imagine it's good having Hulk Hogan himself involved in making a biopic of his life.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, that guy is like an incredible resource and not afraid to tell all of the gory details. And I mean, he's a natural storyteller, as all those guys are. It's an incredible world. I mean,
yeah,
to me.
And this one seems to have gone away. This is where I ask you for but there was a period where you were, because I spoke to Matthew McConaughey and he's like a crazy Evel Knievel fan. And I remember there was this period where you were writing an Evel Knievel movie with Matthew McConaughey potentially as the lead.
Yeah, no, Scott and I, that was another collaboration we did. It's in a phenomenal script. You know, I don't know what the latest is with it, but again, I don't know how much COVID affected it or whatever, but like, I love that script, man. I hope that gets made. I mean, sometimes you write a movie and you're like, oh my God, I'd see that. Sometimes you're like, it's cool, man. I hope I gave you what you wanted. But then you write shit and you're like, oh my God, I would fucking die to see that, which is what I'm trying to write more these days. But that was one of them. And look, knock on wood, I hope that's made too. I love it.
That's crazy.
It's cool having great shit out there that you're like, hopefully it gets made, but it's, you know, it's frustrating, but it's also cool, man. That's a badass movie.
Well, I can imagine, especially when you've got a leading man like in McConaughey, who's like, this guy was a fucking legend. I love this guy and I want to play him.
You know, I mean, how else are you going to find him? You know, he's great. He'd be perfect. I mean, who the fuck knows? Hopefully, like I said, knock on wood. I mean, all we did is you write it and you put it out there and they got to figure all that shit out. So,
yeah. It sounds like potentially though, once this COVID thing finally goes away, which it will do, it will go away and we'll get back to a much more normal than we are now. You're going to be really, really fucking busy.
I mean, I've been pretty busy, but yeah, for sure. I mean, look, it's a dream. It's so hard to make a movie. And, you know, A Small Engine Repair was a dream come true. It's like came out so much deeper and better than I ever imagined it would. You know, It's just the timing. I mean, who knew that I was going to have this movie delivered in the worst time to ever deliver a movie in cinematic history? You know what I mean? With all this stuff. And now that we're coming out in a couple of weeks, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with this thing, but you just got to kind of be zen. I mean, look, there are people suffering far worse than that, but I've had to just say, look, I'm going to put it out there and hopefully people will discover it. If not now, eventually, and you know, see what happens. But I think that's where we're at. And I don't know when things will get back to normal, you know, in terms of that kind of stuff.
I know. I sort of say it all the time because, like, I want to believe it and I want it to happen soon. But yeah, who knows, man? Who knows? But regardless, September the 10th, small engine repair hit cinemas, and people should go out and see it.
I think it's going to be, you know, as is the nature of movies in this sort of current climate, it's going to be on, like, video on demand, I think, like in October at some point too. So,
oh, great.
You know, if people don't go to the theaters or don't have a theater playing it, cause it's not going to be on like 3,000 screens or anything. Mm. I mean, you probably had this moment in your life too, where you heard about this movie that, like, remember, it was Usual Suspects for me. I was like, holy shit. I mean, I drove like 3.5 hours to see that movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause I had to see it. Those, like, where I grew up, the coolest movies didn't necessarily play near where I was. So this may be the case with this. So get in your fucking car and drive.
There you go. That's the hard sell, but no, it's really worth your time. It's a great movie and congratulations on it, John. Thank you for your time, man. Thank you for speaking to me this evening and best of luck it. I hope to see a lot more of you in the future and, you know, you'll have to come back on and we can chat about your next project.
Absolutely, man. I look forward to it. I really enjoy your podcast. All right, brother.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.